Hello, welcome to the show called The Environment. I'm Gene. I'm a volunteer with the Sun Sounds of Arizona organization. And the last time we were together, I was reading an article entitled The Future is Old Growth. The subtitle was The Northeast Has a Few Pre-Colonial Forests Left. Expanding the remaining patches may hold the key to ecological resilience in the centuries to come. This article was written by Krista Langlois, and this is from the Sierra Magazine, the summer 2024 edition. So since it's been a couple of weeks since we've gotten together, I'm going to go back and read a couple of key paragraphs at the beginning of the article that I've already read, just kind of bring us up to speed, and then I'll finish off with the last two pages of the article. It begins with, on his missions to find big trees, Eric Danielson comes across humanity's detritus, often rusty cans and broken glass, the occasional old stone wall or chimney, and once there was a camp chair lodged in a tree, miles from the nearest trail or road. But bushwhacking into the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York on a humid summer morning in 2023, he found no signs that anyone else had been in these woods for a very long time. Now, at first, Danielson's surroundings looked like any other forest in the northeastern United States, a tangle of underbrush and skinny trees fighting for the light, crowded by boulders and stumps. But as he walked in deeper, though, the ecology shifted. The pines became larger, the moss thicker, and the forest harder to navigate because of downed trees and 20-foot cliffs. Danielson recalled saying it was really beautiful, but kind of hard terrain to get around. Unquote. He paused in a ravine framed by a waterfall. And then, climbing up the next ridge, he saw it, the eastern white pine that he would eventually call Bigfoot, at 151 feet tall, more than 16 feet in circumference. It towered over the forest floor. Danielson said, quote, it's got this enormous footprint, and the trunk just goes up and up. And I think to myself, this could be the largest white pine that I've ever seen, unquote. Well, a self-taught botanist who never went to college and fell in love with trees while living in an off-the-grid cabin, he is now a laboratory technician in the Tree Ring Lab at Harvard Forest, the forestry department of Harvard University, and he hunts for big trees in his spare time. Now, Bigfoot, which was later confirmed to be the largest living member of its species by volume, was one of his largest finds yet. But more remarkable than Bigfoot itself was the fact that it was just one tree in a 550-acre tract of white pine forest that has likely stood since before the Civil War. An entire, intact, old-growth forest hiding in one of the nation's most densely populated and ecologically altered regions. Before European colonization, such stands would have been commonplace. As the tallest trees in eastern North America, white pines were said to soar up to 230 feet in pre-colonial times, peppering the vast hardwood forest of the Northeast and upper Midwest. A white pine sheltered leaders in the Haudenosaunee Confederacy as they drafted the Great Law of Peace, which unified five tribal nations and later inspired the U.S. Constitution. Tribal members still know the pine as the Tree of Peace. But to Europeans, however, white pines represented fuel for conquest. So by the 18th century, Europe had few trees left that were tall enough to be fashioned into single-stick ship masts, a construction that was superior to fastening two shorter logs together. So the colonists coveted the long, straight trunks of eastern white pines. In 1772, King George III decreed that any white pine more than 12 inches in diameter was his personal property to be used for the Royal Navy. Enraged colonists in New Hampshire staged what later became known as the Pine Tree Riot. Now, regardless of who owned them, white pines were one of the first species that settlers targeted, reducing stand after stand of them to stumps and slash. Once they had mostly exhausted the white pine supply, they moved on to other tree species. Between 17th and 20th centuries, European settlers cleared more than 99% of the forest in New England and New York, not just once, but two or even three times, first for agriculture and timber, and then for industry. Now, northeastern woods have a remarkable ability to grow back. Today, roughly 80% of the region is again shaded by trees. But most modern forests are the kind of scraggly second or third growth that Danielson bushwhacked through to find Bigfoot. Fairly uniform, with trees roughly the same size and age, and unnaturally young. Some estimates place the age of most northeastern forest at around 100 years old, mere teenagers by arboreal standards. Ecologists generally consider such forest unhealthy, susceptible to disease, lacking in the complexity that makes old-growth forest so ecologically rich. For generations, most people assumed that old growth simply no longer existed in this part of the world. Bob Leverett, a former engineer who identified new areas of old-growth forest in Massachusetts, Bob said, quote, "In the old days, when old growth was brought up, people thought of the Pacific Northwest. A lot of people said, 'Old growth in Massachusetts?'" Unquote. Well, in the 1980s, Leverett and others began documenting remnants of forest in Massachusetts and beyond that had somehow escaped the colonist axes. The trees weren't as big as you might expect. Cold New England winters and regular wind and ice storms prevent trees from reaching the proportions of the West Coast famous evergreens. But, like all old-growth forest, those in the Northeast have evolved through cycles of natural disasters and regrowth. And that differentiates them from forests that have been intensively logged or otherwise managed by people. They have richer soil and a higher diversity of both plants and animals. They store more carbon, and they are more resilient in the face of disease and climate change. They serve as a natural laboratory for studying how forest ecosystems function without human interference. And perhaps just as important, they are places that spark awe and wonder. Over the past few decades, enthusiasts and scientists have identified tens of thousands of acres of old-growth forest in the Northeast. They have found patches in Massachusetts and Maine, New Hampshire and Vermont, New York and Pennsylvania. But until Danielson's mission in the Adirondacks last summer, no one had paid any attention to the area surrounding Bigfoot. Danielson said, quote, "The part I find most mind-blowing is that these old-growth forests have gone undetected. 5 years ago, I wouldn't have thought there was anything like that out there," unquote. Now, as scientists and conservationists and government agencies work to identify and study and protect the ancient forest of the Northeast, they might also be mapping the region's future. Though old growth makes up only a tiny fraction of northeastern woodlands, even fragmented forests, quote, "still carry the ecological legacy of the past," unquote. That's from University of Minnesota forest ecologist Lee Freelich. He said this at a conference. He went on and said, quote, they still carry the microbes, the genetics, the biodiversity, and that legacy can be spread onto the adjacent stands, unquote. So enthusiasts are hopeful that by protecting a layer around the remaining patches of northeastern old growth, the old growth can help nurse the surrounding secondary forest back to health. If we allow the northeast old growth to expand outward, perhaps one day it will anchor a corridor of intact, mature woodlands again stretching from Pennsylvania to Maine. It would be an echo of the forest that once defined the region, and maybe an atonement, perhaps, for their destruction. My own foray into northeastern old growth happened accidentally. I grew up a stone's throw from Holyoke, Massachusetts, an industrial city that at the turn of the 20th century produced 80% of all the writing paper in the United States. My father, grandfather, and great-grandfather, and many other relatives worked in Holyoke's paper product factories. My family, in other words, played a role in transforming virgin forest into reams of paper, and so my interest in the past and future of these forests is partly personal. I have since moved away from New England, but in the summer of 2022, I was home caring for my dad at the end of his life when a friend invited me to go for a hike. We met near the Mohawk Trail, an ancient footpath that is now a two-lane highway in northwestern Massachusetts. Now, the majority of the Bay State's old growth lies in the Mohawk Trail State Forest, though I didn't know that yet. I didn't even know old growth existed in New England. All I knew was that when I left my car and began bushwhacking down a steep ravine, I found myself in an ecosystem that I had never experienced in years of camping and hiking in New England's woods. The first thing I noticed was what was absent. Gone were the choking vines and the creep of poison ivy and the clawing branches. Gone was the claustrophobic competition for light and space. Instead, the forest floor was as open as a park, threaded by wandering streams. It was so thoroughly shaded that the only understory plants were delicate ferns, ladies' slipper orchids, and trillium. Mosses smothered tree trunks. Lichens clung to boulders. Although I couldn't immediately put my finger on what it was, something felt different. And this is how many people describe their first encounter with northeastern old growth, an intangible sensation that precedes any quantifiable observation. They simply feel that they're in the presence of something ancient. That summer, New England had been experiencing crippling heat and drought. Rivers had shrunk to tepid streams. Reservoirs had dwindled, and farmers' crops had withered. Emergency limits on municipal water use had left many lawns brown and brittle. And yet here, water seemed to spring from every imaginable surface, pooling in shady chasms, rushing down in waterfalls, and nourishing fountains of ferns. The forest was so green, it looked nearly tropical, except for a primordial coolness that the afternoon heat could not dispel. Forests have a cooling effect on both their immediate surroundings and the global climate. Studies show that although younger forests sequester atmospheric carbon dioxide more quickly than mature forests, old growth forests store more carbon overall than younger forests do. Because of this, old growth plays an important role in scientific models that use trees' biomass to quantify how much carbon the world's forests store. Many such models rely on large-scale data from young, temperate forest made up of relatively small trees. As forests are allowed to mature, and as people like Danielson, the big tree hunter, find more old growth, it could mean that the computerized models don't accurately reflect what's happening on the ground. Already, new studies have shown that actual biomass and carbon storage of forest can be much higher than what models predicted. Some models may have been proved to be off by as much as 70%. Danielson said, quote, "That has big implications, and we wouldn't have all of those measurements if it weren't for a lot of these informal researchers going out and measuring trees," unquote. In addition to ground-truthing carbon storage models, people are discovering that some tree species in the Northeast can live much longer and get much bigger than some scientists recently believed. In the late 1970s, for instance, foresters thought that eastern hemlock could live to a maximum of around 550 years, because that was the age of the oldest known hemlock. But then, in 2023, Danielson found a huge hemlock in northwest Pennsylvania. Tree coring proved it to be at least 650 years old. It could actually be up to 800 years old. The base of this hemlock's trunk, where the oldest growth rings normally are, is hollow, thus leaving experts to estimate. The maximum known age of many other tree species have similarly increased. Neil Pedersen, an ecologist with Harvard Forest, said, quote, "There's a lot to learn, even with the best studied tree species, and old growth forests are a great place to learn," unquote. For all that old growth can teach us, though, we still live in a landscape battered by centuries of colonialism. Some tree species, like the American chestnut, have been wiped out by blight. Predators such as mountain lions and wolves that once shaped ecosystems with their appetites have been largely missing from the northeastern habitats for centuries, and the salmon that once brought nutrients into the forest are mostly absent too, their migratory routes blocked by dams and development. The traditional ecological practices of indigenous people who tended to northeastern forest are also heavily suppressed. The old growth that we have left, therefore, is far from whole. Many scientists told me that we're just beginning to scratch the surface of understanding how northeastern forests function in the absence of logging or intensive management. Other basic information about northeastern's old growth is likewise underdocumented. When I asked Joan Maloof, who is founder of the Old Growth Network, what percentage of northeastern old growth is permanently protected, and what percentage is found on private lands, she hesitated. She told me, quote, "People tend to assume that we have some sort of map that would show where the old growth is. We don't have that. Nobody has that. Here we are in 2024, and we still don't know exactly where our remaining old growth forests are," unquote. If conservationist end goal is a corridor of mature forest, finding and documenting the existing old growth is the first step toward getting there. Protecting it is the second step. John Davis, who works for both the Regional Adirondack Council and the National Rewilding Institute, said, quote, "You would think that old growth would be automatically protected, but that's not so, not even in the East, where it is scarce," unquote. In the 1990s, Davis's late mother, Mary Bird Davis, cataloged all the northeastern old growth known at that time, and he said that some of those sites have since been lost to logging and development. He went on and said, quote, "Most privately owned old growth is in the hands of conservation-minded families or businesses. Otherwise, it probably would be logged by now. But you cannot assume that goodwill will always prevail," unquote. After a patch of old growth is granted permanent protection, the next step is to protect the forest around it so that it can spread. Now, this may already be happening in the Adirondacks. When New York State created its two largest parks, the Catskill and the Adirondack, nearly 150 years ago, it banned logging and development on all state-owned lands throughout the park's combined 6 million acres, stipulating that they would be, quote, forever kept as wild forest lands, unquote. And that means the 550 acres of white pines surrounding Bigfoot and the additional 75,000 acres of old growth in the Catskills and Adirondacks are safe from logging, and so is the forest around them. Connecting these protected lands is the last step. In one of many such examples, Davis's organization and others are working with local land trust to secure and protect land linking the Adirondacks with Canada's Algonquin Provincial Park. Although all these efforts are piecemeal and different places are at different stages of the process, the overall regional thrust is proceeding in the same direction. We have long known that the forest raised and transformed by European colonists have the ability to recover if we let them. But only now, for perhaps the first time since colonization, does it feel as though a critical mass of individuals and governments and organizations have the willpower, the tools, and the knowledge to support such recovery. As I reported this story and talked with passionate people dedicating their lives and careers to this cause, I began to suspect that the Northeast is on the verge of a vast rewilding. It may not happen in my lifetime, or even my daughter's, but on their own incomprehensibly slow timeline, this forest will recover. As millions of tons of leaves fall from the trees each autumn and settle onto the ground, the forest will heal. As the leaf litter turns into duff, and the duff into humus, and the humus into soil, growing a millimeter deeper at a time, they will heal. As decomposer organisms crawl and fungal roots silently squirm through the soil, they will heal. More and more forest will eventually come to look like the horizontal old growth of Pisgah State Park, or the towering white pines of the Adirondacks, or the decadent emerald woods of Mohawk Trail. As John Davis put it, quote, "I believe in the concept of future old growth," unquote. And that was the article by Krista Langlois. Incidentally, Krista is a Colorado-based writer and a senior editor at Hakai Magazine. That's H-A-K-A-I. And she reports on people and the natural world for publications in such organizations as The Atlantic and The New York Times. And that was the article entitled, "The Future is Old Growth." So I think we have time for a couple of shorter articles. And here's a page entitled "By the Numbers." So the number is 1 billion. That's tons of greenhouse gas emissions the Biden administration is eliminating with new standards for heavy-duty freight trucks and buses. The next number is 3.6 million, the number of heat pumps American consumers purchased in 2023, the second year in a row that heat pumps outsold gas furnaces. The third number is $867 million, the amount that conservation groups say the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service needs in order to fully fund endangered and threatened species recovery. The fourth number is the number 2, the number of times researchers have seen an Atlantic gray whale in U.S. waters in the past 200 years. Both times in the past 2 years. And our final number is 45,000, the record number of conservation projects that the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is an arm of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, awarded last year. And those were some of the things by the numbers. Then we have some victories. We'd like to talk about coal-free New England. Spurred by a lawsuit filed by the Sierra Club and the Conservation Law Foundation, New Hampshire is ditching coal. Last April, Granite Shore Power, the state's last coal plant operator, announced that its two remaining coal plants would close by 2025 and 2028, respectively. Those closures will make all of New England free of coal. And then, thanks to a legal challenge from the Sierra Club and other conservation groups, the Fish and Wildlife Service must reassess a rule that allowed oil and gas companies to harass threatened polar bears and downplay the potentially lethal effects of their operations on newborn cubs. The Marine Mammal Protection Act is supposed to protect the bears, but the Fish and Wildlife Service impermissibly sliced and diced its own modeling results to justify authorizing the harassment. Now the agency will have to review the policy while adhering to the requirements of the law. And those were two victories in the magazine. So we've reached the end of our time together. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. I've been reading from the Sierra Magazine, the summer 2024 edition, and you have been listening to the show called The Environment. I hope you have a great week ahead, and I hope you keep on listening. Goodbye.